Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Welcome back, everyone. Renee Powers here. As you know, most of our episodes feature an interview with an author, but sometimes we like to change it up by interviewing fellow readers who are doing really cool shit in the book world. And today is one of those episodes. Emily Edwards is the host of Fuckboys of Literature, a podcast about the insufferable characters in classic literature, and it's a fantastic show. We're chatting with Emily today all about feminism in classic lit, and we discuss things like, why is the literary canon so goddamn white? And how did subversive feminism bubble up in some of our least favorite books? And why the hell did our teachers assign so much fucking Dickens and Shakespeare? I'm a little fired up about that Dickens. Because this episode is actually part of an interview swap that Emily and I did. I forced myself to reread Great Expectations for the first time since Mrs. Bohr's ninth grade English class. And we chatted about a character that actually made quite an impression on me back then, Miss Havisham. I used to joke that she was my feminist icon, so it was actually kind of nice to revisit her and her character just to see if that statement holds up. So go find the podcast Fuck Boys of Literature wherever you find this podcast and download that episode, which is available today. We'll get into that interview in just a second, but I wanted to take a moment to shout out Virgo Voodoo Jewelry and Accessories, which will be featured in our October subscription box. Subscribers will receive a gorgeous bracelet set from this Cleveland area woman-owned business. Find them on Instagram at IamVirgoVoodoo and definitely check out all of her designs. They're stunning. Our October boxes are still available, so if you'd like to sign up, go over to feministbookclub.com/shop and don't forget to use the code podcast. The monthly subscription is just $42, and that actually includes shipping in the US. So shipping is included in that $42 price. Plus, you'll get the book of the month that our members suggest and vote on, 2 to 4 products from woman-owned businesses, and we will make a monthly donation to our charity beneficiary in your honor. In honor of October being the National Domestic Violence Awareness Month, we'll be donating 5% of our sales, and that's total sales, you guys, not profit, total sales, to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. In other words, for every dollar that you spend at feministbookclub.com, our featured charities receive a nickel of that. And a little bit goes a long way. We've been able to donate several hundred dollars worth every month. And because that also goes for our previous boxes, which are available for $45, and all of our products in our shop. So go see what's available. Place your order today. October boxes will ship next week. So if you want to read some Toni Morrison with us while rocking your bracelet, snacking on some matzo crackers, taking notes on your Shirley Chisholm notepad. In other words, those are all the items that are in your October box. If you want to do that with us, make sure you reserve yours ASAP. That's feministbookclub.com/shop. And make sure you get that order in before October 5th, which is when the cutoff date is. Now, let's get on to our discussion with Emily Edwards. Hi, everyone. I'm so excited for today's interview. I am chatting with Emily Edwards. She is the host of the podcast Fuckboys of Literature, and I'm going to have her introduce herself. Hi, Emily.
Hi, how are you?
I'm so excited.
I know, me too. Thank you for having me on. You know, I've been a writer of all sorts of different kinds of things for the last 10 years or so since I graduated. And, you know, I was a radio producer for a long time, and then everything just coalesced into doing this. And it's been the most amazing, fantastic community of people that I've gotten to speak with and work with. It's been an absolute dream.
So tell me, wait, hold on. No, the first question that I usually ask people, we'll go there, is what is your definition of literature?
My definition of literature is, you know, literally anything that entertains. I can, you know, go from anything from classic literature to comic books to even movies, to me is included in that sort of storytelling sphere. It's very broad. I like to keep it broad. I agree.
So I'm going to confess something very quickly. I am only a cup of coffee in, and that's not the first question I usually ask people. I was thinking about the title of your show, and I transposed mentally literature with feminism. The first question I usually ask people is, what is your definition of feminism? Oh. I don't know what's happening this morning, but we're going to go with it. So tell me your definition of feminism.
My definition of feminism is literally, I think I try to keep that pretty broad, and just promoting equality between people of any and all genders.
In order to kind of position this conversation, how do you identify in whatever way makes sense to you?
Cishet female, you know? Yep. There's nothing complicated on my end.
Yep. And racially, educationally, geographically?
Caucasian, white, female from Connecticut. I live in Southern California now. I am the most, you know, I always like to tell people I have the second most societal power that can be, you know, given to someone by the patriarchy. I literally, the only inconvenience I have is that I wasn't born a dude. So yeah. I have ever, you know, and I fully admit it. And it's, I think it's the only way to be rational going forward about how I discuss things. I can't, you know, beat around the bush.
Right, right. And I think it's so important that we acknowledge our privilege and our position in society because, yeah, we didn't ask for these privileges, but that doesn't mean that we don't also benefit from them. And so
absolutely.
We move forward yielding those benevolently. Yeah.
Exactly. I think the only way to break down power structures is to acknowledge the ones that you benefit from. So I literally do a self audit, you know, like I benefit from growing up, you know, upper middle class in Connecticut, in a place that was majority white, you know. I find it distasteful when people go out of their ways to try to find ways in which they were perhaps, you know, worked against in by privilege in society. I'm not going to claim sexualities that aren't mine and things like that. That really rubs me the wrong way. I can only move forward by acknowledging my own massive amounts of privilege that I've grown up with and continue to benefit from.
Right, right. Well, moving on from that, I could talk about identity and positionality and privilege and intersectionality all day, but we're not here to talk about that. We are here to talk about fuckboys. So what is a fuckboy?
You know, a fuckboy, I didn't start with a set definition. I tried to work with my guests who volunteered to come on to try to figure out what society considers it. And the word started out in, you know, African-American vernacular English in New York City as just a bad dude that you don't want to be around. But as the word has disseminated away from the original culture that created it, it has taken on a romantic context that I don't think was initially intended. So it's easier to talk about it in sexual relationships of people who abuse societal power that they have against their partner or partners.
So to wrap it all up, if you could do it in one sentence, a fuckboy is?
A fuckboy is someone who utilizes their societal powers against the person or people that they're in romantic relationships with.
Okay. Okay. So we are doing this interview today as kind of a two-parter. And over on your podcast, Fuckboys of Literature, we are talking about Miss Havisham from Great Expectations as a fuckboy. Yes. But what Absolutely. Are some of your favorite or kind of most appalling fuckboys of classic literature?
I think that who initially spurred me to start this podcast was actually Edward Rochester from Jane Eyre. And I think that he's someone who comes up in every single conversation I have about literary fuckboys. He has so much societal and also romantic control over Jane, and he utilizes it in the worst possible way against Bertha, against Jane, against his housekeeper, against all the women who are in Jane Eyre. And, you know, it's kind of spurred the conversation of, are you someone who considers Jane Eyre a love story, or are you, as the phrase that's been going around on Twitter, team attic wife? And I think we are mostly team attic wife on my side of the podcast.
So what does that mean? I love that phrase.
Bertha Mason in Jane Eyre is Rochester's first wife. And he declares to Jane that she is not of sound mind. And so he locks her in the attic. And that is a major plot point. And Bertha begins to sort of creep out of the attic. She escapes and begins to essentially harass Jane and Rochester to the point that she burns down the house and leaves Edward Rochester blind and disfigured.
God bless her.
Yeah, exactly. She does a lot of good work. She dies in the process because obviously it was written, you know, in Victorian era, because you can't have her get away unpunished, of course, but at least she does the good work.
Exactly.
Of retaliating against her husband who locked her in an attic.
Jesus. So how did you get into wanting to dissect classic literature like this?
I was a literature major in college. I went to Emerson, and the major is called Writing, Literature, and Publishing. So I went predominantly for the writing and publishing aspect of it. And then throughout learning about literature, because it was required and was something I didn't want to do, I, thank goodness, had the good luck of having very feminist, very forward-thinking literature professors. So the first time I read Jane Eyre, it was taught to me by my professor, who was also the women's lit professor. So I'm just imagine this woman with like three PhDs standing in front of a classroom of bored college sophomores going like, this is bullshit. Can you believe that this is considered romantic? And it's like, thank God I had that perspective going up. So
that's awesome. The first time I read Jane Eyre was sophomore year of high school. And I say read very loosely because I'm pretty sure I didn't read it and just like BS'd all of the essays.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's good to remember that when you are doing literature classes, and a pro tip to anybody listening, you're not a literature major to actually read the books. You're a literature major to convince people you read the books. That is the secret to being a literature major.
That was the secret to my AP English classes in high school.
Exactly.
Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about feminism in classic literature, because I think it's a conversation that is only starting to emerge more. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, when we talk about classic literature, the first things we think of are, you know, the old dead white guy canon. But there's also, we'll throw in some, you know, the Bronte sisters and some,
exactly,
you know,
Jane Austen,
like, exactly. Still, you know, privileged white women. But
oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So in terms of this topic, feminism, classic literature, what direction do you want to go?
You know, I think it's more prevalent than people like to admit, but you are correct that it's like incredibly difficult to parse out, because you still always have the veneer of religion and the veneer of, especially in European literature, of societal and class systems over top. So it's not intersectional. It's not the feminism that we want moving forward, but it's imperative that we talk about the fact that feminism in literature is there going back hundreds of years in what we consider classic literature.
What do you think is the most feminist classic text that you're familiar with?
That I'm familiar with? You know, I didn't give Jane Austen the credit that she was due prior to starting this podcast. I had always just considered it sort of like fluffy love stories because that's how it's usually presented. But I didn't know really that she was writing essentially satire when she was writing things like Pride and Prejudice to purposefully make fun of the class system and the people of upper classes in England at her time. So I had absolutely no idea. I just thought people were reading them almost like chaste Harlequin romances, which, you know, have their own value. I'm not, you know, poo-pooing them. But the fact that she was writing it as a means to, you know, satirize the people that were around her and the classes that she wasn't a part of was wildly interesting to me. I don't think that gets covered as much as it should when people are being taught those books.
Yeah, I actually never read any Jane Austen, and I've seen Pride and Prejudice on stage, and I think maybe mm-hmm. I've seen the movie. I don't know. I don't remember it, but I've read a lot of kind of retellings of Austenian
mm-hmm. yeah, exactly. Austenian canon, we'll say.
Yes, exactly. And I find them very charming, but also subversive. And I'm thinking particularly, one of our first books we read for the Feminist Book Club was called Austenistan, edited. Mm-hmm. It's a series of short stories edited by Laaleen Sukeyra. And it is the retelling of Jane Austen stories in modern Pakistan, written by Pakistani authors.
Fantastic.
It is gorgeous. And I talked to some of the authors. We did like a Facebook Live with some of the authors. Mm-hmm. And the parallels between Victorian England and modern day Pakistan are striking. And there's still, you know, a caste system. There's still a lot of society,
right.
You know, issues coming
rules
up
and regulations.
Yeah. And still, you know, marriage is seen as one of the most important things. And mm-hmm. there are, from what I understand, being just a fan of literature, but not necessarily a scholar of anything in the classics.
Yeah.
What I understand is there are still so many lessons that we can learn from Jane Austen that I don't think she gets credit for.
Yeah, I think she has such an interesting, a modern concept of upward mobility that wasn't really part of the conversation back then. I've been reading a lot of things that are from about the same time, you know, in our perspective, certainly, you know, a lot of the female writers from back then, their lives didn't overlap and there was only allowed to be one. But things that we consider of the same era, like Tess of the D'Urbervilles, and I'm reading Middlemarch right now for an upcoming episode. You know, they talk about life in the country as though it is set and finite and almost like there's fences around them. And the way that Austen discussed class mobility and, you know, land ownership and things like that, it's incredibly modern for, you know, that time period. The fact that you could marry up and you didn't have to, you know, debase your station and things like that. Or the fact that the Bennet sisters, you know, they really had no land and no futures to hope for. And then all of a sudden they're enamored with men of wealth and privilege. And the fact that they had basically the chutzpah to go for it and try to make it their lives is incredibly fascinating.
It's almost as though they were gaming the system. Like, these are the rules that are laid out mm-hmm. before us, and we're going to figure out how to use them in our favor.
Yeah, they found the loopholes.
And yeah.
That's such an interesting way. And usually when you talk about a character that's, you know, found a loophole, it's presented to you in almost like an evil or like villainous way. But because it's women who have found the loopholes to, you know, increasing their station or finding happiness or working outside of, you know, societal expectations of marriage, it's we read it now, and we probably did back when it was written, as an unbelievable triumph for these basically like poor siblings who had no hope of a future.
Yeah. And what could be more feminist than that, right? Women
exactly.
Women finding the loopholes to power. Yeah.
Exactly.
That's so interesting. You know, I don't think that I had given Jane Austen that kind of credit.
You know, I think it's difficult to do also now in realizing that they are white, they are, you know, probably lower to middle class for, or like lower middle class for their time period. They're educated enough to know what the rules are and things like that. So they are starting out with a fair amount of privilege. But at the time, Jane Austen couldn't write about anybody who was lower on the privilege ladder than that.
Right.
You know, there was just a certain, you know, cutoff in English society. And because we are stuck with, in America, English, British literature and European literature essentially as the only canon that we are allowed to read, mm-hmm. you know, in most classic literature classes, we are given that basement that doesn't include, you know, people of Asian descent and African descent, things like that. And it just, it drives me up a wall because it's there, it's existing, but we don't go back that far.
Why do you think that the old white guy canon is what it is? What created the genre of the classics?
It's a really good question. I think it's literally so much of it has to do with the church. I don't think that there's removing that influence from a lot of like the old dead white guy canon. And it's just people who had the money, power, or someone who had the money and power to print and bind them. We don't have pamphlets or things that weren't bound and things that weren't treated as respectable texts going back much farther than that. I think it's literally just who in power or who had the power to maintain the stories that they wanted other people to tell.
Okay, so that's brilliant. My degrees are in communication studies with a focus on media and technology. And so I'm fascinated by this idea that technology is actually mm-hmm. what perpetuated this old white guy canon. I think the things that the people who had the money to print the stories are the old white guys.
Yeah, or bind them in anything more substantial than, you know, if you're the person who's working on a palimpsest, you know, where they essentially erased what was on the paper or, you know, a medium before then, and you wrote over it, you know, that degrades the quality of what you're writing on. It's literally just about who got access to the, like you said, technology to make their work last. I don't think people give the technology of printing or of disseminating stories as much attention as they should, because the power of technology is always going to be rooted in the ruling class. I know this is going to sound ridiculous, but it's why people were really up in arms when the app Vine went away.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember when that
happened? Oh, yeah.
And everybody was like, well, the majority of the people who are Vine stars or people who are making really interesting things are Black and not white. And then all of a sudden, the app went away. It just got absorbed by something. And everybody was just kind of like, well, what happens to these storytellers who are using a free app to make the stories and to share just things that they find joyous and they find entertaining? And it just went away.
Mm-hmm.
And it just went to the ether because whatever tech company bought it didn't value those stories and those particular pieces of joy. And it's infuriating when you realize that we have certain literary texts and certain classic stories simply because the church or the ruling class decided that's the only valuable story that we have here.
Right, right. And so much of the non-white, non-male stories, those without technology, that's why we get these, you know, oral histories and mm-hmm. storytelling as kind of a cultural phenomenon in certain cultures. And many times, especially way back in the day, whatever that means, they didn't have the ability to write. And so they couldn't write down these stories. And so they get lost, but they get passed down, but then they get, you know, they kind of morph.
I mean, even American literacy rates didn't hit majority until what, the 1940s and 50s?
Right. And so I think there's something I love your broad definition of literature, and I'm so glad that I accidentally asked you that question, because it includes these stories too, because it's not just the canon that we need to be talking about. It's also the oral stories.
And using the word literature, it commands respect.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you have to include things like like comic books and film and like you're saying, like oral stories and even like anything long form narrative, you have to include it in the umbrella of literature or else it's never going to get the respect that it deserves. I value any story that entertains me and keeps my attention long enough for me to gain anything from it. It has to be, you know, you can't just continue to go, oh, well, that's just like a Twitter thread. Well, it might be 40 tweets long and it might have had a beginning, a middle, and an end and a narrative purpose. So why can't that be considered a short story? Why can't that be considered microfiction and given the attention and respect that it deserves, especially if thousands and thousands and thousands of people are reading it?
Yes, you struck a chord with me again that there is a policing of what constitutes literature. And when we open it up, we invite more voices in as well.
And one thing that I've found by doing my podcast is that people will happily regurgitate the ideas that they're given, that this is a valuable piece of literature that has this message. And the second you start to challenge it, people get very uncomfortable. For example, like I was talking about Jane Eyre, and you've been told for the last 150 some odd years that this is a romantic story and a romantic ideal. And then when you talk about the fact that Rochester is abusive to not one, but two women in his life, and he's stealing from people and he's doing incredibly shady things. And these are not things that you should bring to a romantic relationship. People get very angry. And when you start to challenge the messages of literature, and especially old dead white guy literature or old dead white people literature, people get really upset. And I think this is a fight that's really worth having right now, of saying who is worthy of respect, whose literature is valuable, and the things that you're teaching other people, maybe we should, you know, question the lessons that are being taught about the old dead white people canon.
So if you could assign any book to yourself in high school.
Oh boy.
What would it be? And with a caveat, you have a good English teacher.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I was very lucky that I did have one fantastic like literature teacher when I was in high school. And he really changed how I addressed, you know, how I addressed reading and how I addressed literature. But having read what I've read, because let me be honest with you, I was the worst literature major in the world. I did not read anything that I was assigned in college. I'm trying to think. I don't want to say Jane Eyre because I still hate it to this day. But I've now read it like two or three times. I hate it. But it might just be that, because I think it is the best way for me to address reading something before you have a feminist vocabulary and a feminist understanding, and reading something after you have a feminist understanding.
Interesting. So you think that the reading of Jane Eyre changes the more you become exposed to feminist theory and feminist thought?
I would think so, because for me also, and it's really gotten into my brain about reading this book, and especially because race comes into it. The original, Rochester's first wife is not white, and class comes into it, and just so many societal forces come into that book that are usually not addressed when they're being taught in sort of like rudimentary literature classes, that I think that if you can read Jane Eyre as the story of a love story and then understand the societal forces at work, you'll have the toolkit to read other books and other pieces of literature with sort of a better lens of looking at the word choices and what characters are displayed as and how characters are written, and be able to sort of parse out better understanding of the society that it was written in.
Mm. I wish I would have had a better English teacher. I read that. Or maybe, you know what? I'm sure she was wonderful. I know she was wonderful. She was a great human. I wish I would have cared more. Or paid
you can't more until you're certain. I think you can't really understand certain levels of literary implications until you've witnessed more of life. I would not have gotten anything out of these books when I was a teenager or even in my 20s, because I was leading this incredibly privileged life and I didn't have access to people who didn't have these privileges.
Why do we get taught these books then so early? I mean, you know, I was reading Great Expectations again for the first time in, you know, 20 years. And I just thought there was no way I was grasping any of this.
Yeah, same here. I read Romeo and Juliet my freshman year of high school. Totally didn't get the implications of, like, Romeo goes from pining over Rosaline to the point that he's threatening to hurt himself because she won't marry him to, you know, pining over Juliet and literally killing himself because she won't, you know, she did marry him in the course of like 2 days. You don't understand the ramifications of that kind of like brain switch when you're 14.
Yeah. I don't remember that at all.
Oh, it's wild. It is wild. Like, pick it up again. It's a really short play. Like, it's mind-boggling.
Wow. Yeah, no. I read that in the eighth grade.
Mm-mm. I don't know. Literally, I don't want to sound really sinister, but literally the only reason I can think of why these books are taught in the way they're taught at the ages that they're taught is to continue to drive home the idea of importance of white patriarchy.
Oh, shit. Mic drop.
It sounds really sinister and it sounds really negative, but I can't think of any other way. Like, when I was later in high school, I started reading, like, I started getting assigned, like, the weird shit. Like, I had, but it's still white men. Like, I had a whole, like, Kurt Vonnegut unit, and I got to read Catch 22 in one of my classes. And it's like, okay, now we're getting into the sort of, like, slightly anti-establishment stuff. But when you're young, the only toolkit you're given is these dead white guys are important and everything they say is what you should live your life by. Mm-hmm. There's no other reason.
Mm. Yeah, it's just because, honestly, I think this is the way it's always been, and therefore this is the way it's always done. And therefore, you know, in ninth grade, you read Great Expectations. In 10th grade, you read The Crucible. In 11th grade, you read Ivanhoe and Beowulf. I mean, it was just like,
yeah. And you have just no hope of understanding this language, especially Beowulf and things that are written that long ago. It's a completely different language. I think the test is literally like an endurance test to see if you can actually do it.
Agreed. Or at least bullshit your way through it.
Exactly.
Well, Emily, this has been absolutely delightful. Our time is winding down. Do you have a classic book that you would recommend to our readers in terms of like subversive feminism that is hiding in the pages that we may not have been taught as a high school or college student?
I will admit that I have only started rereading classic literature since I started doing this podcast, and I am just learning and just finding new ways to read now in my mid-30s. So I don't think I have any recommendations right now. I would suggest go back and reread things that you didn't loathe reading when you were a kid and try to figure out why you didn't hate them. And go back and reteach yourself the literary canon that you were given and reassess.
What's been the most striking one that you've revisited?
To be honest with you, I had never read A Clockwork Orange prior to this, but it was always on my summer reading list for all my like honors and AP classes. And I'd never read it before. And I just read it for an upcoming episode. And it was mind-boggling how real to life and real to current life it actually was.
Nice.
I mean, content warnings up the wazoo. Like, right. There's really horrendous things in there. But it was mind-boggling to me how in the 1960s, this, you know, dystopian future, it's there.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I read, that is one that we did in high school, was 1984. And now
Yeah.
Now it's hard. It's hard to think about.
It's, Yeah. You also don't like to think of literature for baby boomers as being like, I have a generational thing of like, baby boomers. Yeah. But, you know, they were onto something. They saw some of this coming, whether or not they like went in for it, you know, whole different podcast. But yeah, some of the baby boomer lit is astoundingly prescient.
Well, this has been really fun. And I can't wait. We haven't recorded the Great Expectations episode of Fuckboys of Lit yet. We're about to do that, but they're both up this week. So go over to Fuckboys of Lit, subscribe, find Emily on social media, listen to that episode, listen to all of the episodes. And where can we find you on social media?
I am mostly on Twitter. I do a lot of tweeting and I'm at Fuckboys, that's B-O-I-S of Lit. And you can also find me at fuckboysoflit.com or my personal Twitter, which is Ms. Emily Edwards.
Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
This has been fun.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.